وليغفر الله أكبر. الله أكبر الله أكبر.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the Creator and the Sustainer of the Universe, I greet you with all of the greetings from Prophet Adam through to Prophet Muhammad. Peace and blessings be upon him. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Welcome to Islam in Focus. In today's program, we'll be having the 10th and concluding session in our series on prophethood in Islam. We'll continue our discussions, which we started last week, on the effect of belief in all prophets on the Muslims' attitude and actions towards non-Muslims, particularly Christians and Jews. More specifically, in today's program, we'll be dealing with the common stereotype that Islam was spread by the sword. I have with me as my guest on today's program, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Welcome to Islam in Focus, Dr. Badawi. Since today's topic is related to our program that we had last week, for the benefit of our viewers who may not have seen last week's program, can you give us just a brief summary of the main points that we discussed in last week's program?
Five basic issues I believe we discussed last time. One was that the general rule that the Quran establishes for the relationship between Muslims and non-Muslims is that of justice, kindness, and peaceful coexistence. And we refer particularly to chapter 60, which has lots of information on this. And we said that within this general rule that applies to all non-Muslims, we find that the Quran addresses the Jews and Christians in a particular term, the people of the book. And we explain why they are giving that special status and the fact that they are common to Muslims in at least the basic notion of believing in God, the prophethood, revelation, basic moral code of life, and the life hereafter. Thirdly, we said that within this basic rule that applies to all, there are definitely exceptions, and the Quran also specifies those exceptions, including those mentioned in chapter 60 and chapter 5, and that is people who are really committing hostilities and violence against Muslims, that they cannot expect to have friendship and intimacy. In the first point, we said that even in these cases, or in these exceptions, the door is not closed to friendship. We quoted in the Quran, particularly chapter 41, verses 33 through 35, in which it's mentioned there also that one should inculcate in himself the attitude of forgiveness and tolerance, and so long as the attitudes of hostility and violence against Muslims ceases, then a person would even extend friendship to those who previously were regarded as regarded themselves as enemies.
Yes.
And finally, as an additional evidence of this attitude of tolerance as documented in the Quran, we refer to chapter 5 verse 6 in particular, in which it shows there that the food of the people of the book, that is the meat slaughtered by Jews and Christians, is allowed for Muslims to eat, but not meat slaughtered by atheists or polytheists. And we said that the ultimate evidence of this tolerance is the fact that in Islamic law, a Muslim male is permitted to get married to a Jewish or Christian woman, but not necessarily to those who are atheists or polytheists, which is a special privilege again. And we mentioned that the relationship of marriage is the biggest evidence of extension of friendship and peaceful coexistence, hopefully, in the matter of relationship with non-Muslims.
Right. Well, getting right into today's topic, a claim is often made by people that Islam was spread by the sword. You either converted to Islam, or you die. Is there anything in the Quran which deals with this issue of compulsion in religion? What does the Quran have to say about this?
Definitely the Quran has something to say about that. Of course, this is a vital and important topic, and the Quran being a complete revelation does not leave out any aspect of human life. To start with, I'd like to say that there is no single verse or ayah, no single verse in the entire Quran or in the saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that either encourages or condones compulsion in religion by use of force, pressure, or manipulation. Perhaps you're entitled to demand documentation of this. Perhaps the most obvious and most clear self-explanatory documentation is found in chapter 2, verse 256. And it says, لا إكراه في الدين قد تبين الرشد من الغي. That is, let there be no compulsion in religion. Truth stand out clear from error. So in other words, not only is the Quran silent on the issue, it actually is very clear and very positive, forbidding a true Muslim from committing these acts of compulsion. The Quran further indicates that the matter of guidance is not something that we decide on, that guidance is totally in the hand of God. Like, for example, in chapter 10, verses 99 and 100, it says, if it had been thy Lord's will, they could all believe, all who are on earth. Will you then, that is, will you then, O Muhammad, compel mankind against their will to believe? No soul can believe except by the will of God. Very obvious, very straightforward. Also, we find that the idea or the concept of bringing people to account on as to whether they believed or not is a matter that is not up to us, that only God is the judge, and he is the one to hold people whether they have believed or not. Indeed, the Quran is very clear on the fact that the mission of Prophet Muhammad and those who follow him is simply to convey the message. For example, in chapter 13, verse 40, it says, thy duty, part of it says, thy duty, O Muhammad, is to make the message reach them. It is our part, that is God's part, to call them to account. There are numerous other evidences that you can find in the Quran. For example, the verse that says that remind, you are only a reminder, you're not a guardian or controller over them. In chapter 22, verse 17, there are similar statements also, that the matter of faith is something that no power on earth can force. It lies in the hands of God when the heart is enlightened, the mind is open to receive the truth, but no other human effort can bring it forth or bring that about. And more specifically, like I said, the question of compulsion is very clearly condemned in the Quran, whether it's, like I said, force, pressure, or manipulation.
Well, if the Quran forbids the Muslim from using force in the spreading of Islam, what methods are permissible for the spreading of Islam according to the Quran, to bring the message to people who are non-Muslims?
Perhaps I can give you the answer directly from the Quran. I'll just select two relevant verses. The first one appears in chapter 16, verse 125, which applies to all, whether Jews, Christians, or others. And it says, "Udu ila sabil Rabbika bil hikmati wal maw'izati al hasana wajadilhum billati hiya ahsan." That is, invite all to the way of thy Lord with wisdom and beautiful preaching, and argue with them in ways that are best and most gracious. It doesn't say use the sword or pressure or manipulation. Argue with them in ways that are best and most gracious. For thy Lord knows best who have strayed from his path and who receives guidance. As far as the Jews and Christians in particular, or people of the book, we find that the Quran also makes a special reference to the approach in discussing religious matters with them. And that's the criteria against which you can hold anybody's behavior in question. And that appears in chapter 29, verse 46. And it says, وَلَا تُجَادِلُوا أَهْلَ الْكِتَابِ إِلَّا بِالَّتِي هِيَ أَحْسَنِ. That is, dispute you not, that dispute you, O Muslims, not, with the people of the book, that is Jews and Christians, except with means better than mere disputation, unless it be with those of them who inflict wrong and injury. But say, We believe in the revelation which has come down to us, and in that which has come down to you. Our God and your God is one God, and it is to Him that we bow in Islam or in submission. I don't think I need to add anything more to this. The verses are so obvious and so self-explanatory.
Yes. Jihad is a word, again, that is used quite a bit. How do the teachings that we've just been discussing from the Quran, how do these relate to the concept of jihad?
Well, the biggest problem when you discuss the concept of jihad is that in English, the common translation given to jihad is holy war. And to start with, nowhere in the entire Quran, nor in the saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is the equivalent of the English term holy war found anywhere. I know that this might sound rather certain, but it's true. Because holy war in English, aside from the connotated meaning that goes with fanaticism and forcing people in faith and so on, even if you take the term itself, holy war, translated into Arabic, it means harb muqaddasa. And that term, harb muqaddasa, never appeared anywhere in the Quran or in the saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, to start with. So I think it's a very misleading and distorted translation to call jihad a holy war. And I think this is the first point to start with. The word jihad in Arabic comes from the Arabic root jahida, or juhd, that is exert or exertion of effort or striving or struggling.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense then, the true meaning of the term jihad as found in the Quran, and I'll give you further evidence of this, means simply to exert effort, to strive or struggle mm-hmm. in the path of God and for His pleasure, or for His cause. In that sense then, it is erroneous, like some people for granted say, there used to be some kind of pillar, another pillar of Islam, and that is jihad. It is not the fifth or sixth pillar. Jihad, or struggle for the sake of God, in that sense, is not one pillar of Islam, it is the essence of Islam. We said Islam means submission to the will of God. How do you submit? You submit through jihad. You submit by struggling and striving and exerting efforts in order to please God or to follow His commands. So in that sense, like I said, jihad is the essence of Islam in one sense. Just to give you one documentation, the very term jihad is used, for example, in the Quran in reference to striving. In chapter 29, verse 69, which is the last verse in that chapter, it says, وَالَّذِينَ جَاهَدُوا فِينَا لَنَهْدِيَنَّهُمْ سُبُلَنَا. So the word, or a derivative of jihad, jahadu,
yes.
exerted, appears there. And the translation, and those who strive in our cause, that is, in God's cause, we will certainly guide them to our path, for verily God is with those who do right. There are other citations also. I can refer you, for example, to chapter 22, verses 77 and 78, where it is very obvious there that jihad is related and connected there with worship, with even prayers, which shows that any action, any exertion or struggling that the individual performs for the sake of God is actually within the confines of the definition of jihad. This does not exclude, to be honest, the fact that one aspect of that jihad might take the form of military encounters for self-defense or for the fighting of oppressors. There's no question about that. But it's erroneous to say that jihad means or is connotated directly with fighting. Fighting could be, or legitimate fighting could be one aspect of jihad, but not the totality of jihad.
Right. I think many of our viewers would be interested in this point, because the explanation that you're giving it, I think, is a little bit different than most people have commonly come to think of when they think of jihad. Would you mind just going on, perhaps, and elaborating a little further on the various levels of jihad?
Okay. One way of looking at it, when you say that the essence of Islam is jihad, or struggling in the path of God, you can possibly divide that into three levels, let's say. One is jihad within oneself, on the individual level. One is jihad or struggle on the social level or community level. And the third is jihad on the global or general,
yes.
Universal level. As far as jihad on the individual level, the Prophet of Islam himself explained that, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. One time he was returning back from a battle with the pagans, and he told his companions, hey, now we are returning from the minor jihad or minor struggle to the major struggle. So people raised eyebrows. You know, people were already putting their lives on the line in defense of Islam and defense of, their land. And now he's telling them that this was minor.
Yes.
It sounds rather, sounds strange to them. Mm-hmm. So they asked him, what is that major jihad? What could be more than that? He said, jihad al-nafs, struggling against evil inclinations within ourselves. Which means then that the very foundation of, or the very core of jihad or struggle, is jihad against ourselves, against the evil within ourselves, and that is the cornerstone for any other level or form of jihad. A second level could be regarded as jihad or struggle within society. That is struggle against evil and indecency, against oppression and injustice. And this is known in Islamic terminology, as it appears in the Quran, as Amr bima'ruf and Nahi an munkar, that is ordaining all that is good and decent and forbidding or discouraging all that is evil and indecent. So that's another jihad, because you struggle in society. When you try to change rotten and corrupt things, you have some difficulties that you have to face, and you have to exert certain effort, you have to convince people, you have to talk to them, and that's one aspect of jihad. Jihad is not by the sword only, jihad is also by the tongue, by writing, by conviction. A third level then would be the global jihad, which could mean also the fighting against oppression, not only within one limited community. Islam does not acknowledge all these artificial lines determining this belongs to this state or that state. Oppression is oppression. Whenever it's found in the world, Muslims have the obligation to try and fight it and try to stop it.
Yes.
And this is one aspect of the universality of Islam. This may take the form of actual battles if other peaceful means fail to bring a halt to this violation of basic human rights of other people and their freedom of choice.
Historically speaking, the teachings we've just been discussing and the good explanation you've just been giving us, have these teachings of the Quran been adhered to by Muslims, historically speaking?
When you address a question like that, we have to be perfectly honest, and I might say we should avoid two very common extremes, not only dealing with Islam, but whenever you discuss the history of any people, or followers of any faith, that it would be unfair and inaccurate to say that the history of Muslims, which extends over 1400 years, in all parts of the world, which included hundreds of millions, and under all kinds of circumstances, have all been nothing but a series of violations of the teachings of the Quran, and that their behavior has nothing to do whatsoever with the Quran. I think this is just going or cutting things a little bit too far. But there's also another very similar type of extreme, that anybody who comes and says that the history of any people or followers of any faith for 1400 years in all kinds of places, is nothing but a history of angels where no infraction and no deviation whatsoever has taken place. I think this is not correct and not an honest way of putting it at all. It just applies, like I said, to anybody or to any followers of any faith. An example of this. No sincere Christian would accept the statement, for example, that if you wanted to understand Christianity, you have to explain the barbarous crusades or the Inquisition in Spain or the fighting at present in Northern Ireland between Protestants and Catholics. Because any sincere Christian would say, hey, you better go back to the teaching of Christianity and find whether people's behavior measure up to those standards or not. The same thing applies to Islam and, as I said, to any other people. However, suffice to say at this juncture, because the details would require actually a separate series on history, and we hope to get into that, but suffice to say now that the notion or claim, which is very stereotype type of claim, that Islam was spread or preserved by the sword, is nothing really more than a legend or myth, which was really deliberately circulated in the medieval times for well-known reasons, which might have some extension even today. However, it is something that no serious modern scholar or historian is accepting or making anymore. There might be some, but very few
accepted. Well, when you refer to modern historians and scholars, are you referring to some Muslim scholars and historians?
No, not necessarily. In fact, if you have more time, I can show you.
We have about 10 minutes. But
over 26 different quotations, but let me select a few of them.
Yes.
Some of the very well-known names in the West. For example, Delassie O'Leary, in his book Islam at the Crossroads, all of these are Christian scholars, says, history makes it clear, however, that the legend of fanatical Muslims sweeping through the world and forcing Islam at the point of sword upon the conquered races is one of the most fantastically absurd myths the historians have ever repeated.
Mm-hmm.
Take another famous author, James Michener, most people are familiar with him. He wrote an article in 57 in Reader's Digest in which he says, no other religion in history spread so rapidly as Islam. The West has widely believed that this surge of religion was made possible by the sword. But no modern scholar accepts that idea. And the Quran is explicit in support of the freedom of conscience. A very famous scholar on religion also, A.S. Tritton, in his book Islam, he says, the picture of Muslim soldiers advancing with a sword in one hand and the Quran in the other is quite false. A very well-known historian, the British historian he says that Islam flourished because it was the best social and political order of the time could offer, and that in his book History of the World. Just one more, if you will, another Orientalist, Gibbon, he says that the claim that Islam spread by the sword is a pernicious tenet that has been imputed on Muhammadans. I have dispute, of course, with the term Muhammadan, which is offensive and inaccurate, but at least the duty of extirpating all other religions by the sword. This charge of ignorance and bigotry is refuted by the Quran, by the history of Musulman, which means, by that means Muslims,
right.
Musulman conquerors, and by their public and legal toleration of the Christian worship. As early as the 6 years of Hijra, that's the migration of the Prophet, he says, the Prophet granted to the monks of the monastery of St. Catherine near Mount Sinai, and to all Christians, a charter which secured to the Christians all their privileges and immunities. And the Muslims were enjoined to protect the Christians, to guard them from all injuries, and to defend their churches and residences of their priests. They were not to be unfairly taxed. No bishop was to be driven out of his bishopric. No Christian was to be forced to reject his religion. No monk was to be expelled from his monastery. No pilgrim was to be detained from his pilgrimage, nor were the Christian churches to be pulled down for the sake of building mosques or houses for Muslims. Christian women married to Muslims were to enjoy their own religion and not to be subjected to compulsion or annoyance of any kind on that account. If the Christians should stand in need of assistance for repair of their churches and monasteries, or any other matters pertaining to their religion, the Muslims were to assist them. Again, like I said, all of these are Christian historians and scholars. There are many others, Bernard Shaw, the British historian, Arnold Toynbee, and many others. Like I said, any respectable and serious author can no longer hold to this mythical or legendary claim that Islam is spread by the sword.
Right.
Absolutely.
So far in the discussion of our topic, we've been discussing what the Quran has to say about this whole question of this compulsion in Islam. And we've dealt with some other, some very enlightening references from some of the modern scholars who look at this matter. But are there any other additional sources or any other additional factual information that you can share with us to confirm the fact that Islam was not spread by the sword?
Okay, I can give you a few points, but I just want to make one remark, that the biggest mix that took place is that some people mixed up between the early wars that Muslims during the lifetime of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and immediately after, were wars just to compel people to accept religion. because, like I said, the Quran does not condone, does not accept that, and this did not happen. Their wars and their fighting was either in self-defense against those who tried to destroy them, and there are lots of historical evidence, and we can discuss that later, or to remove, like I said, human tyranny. And everybody knows what kind of treatment the subjects of the Persian and Byzantine Empire were getting.
Even
many of the non-Muslim historians, and I have some quotations here to that effect, indicate that there is evidence that some of the natives in those countries that were conquered by Muslims were welcomed very warmly, and some of them even joined in their lines to fight against their co-religions who were persecuting them, whether they were Persians or Byzantine emperors. So this is another area that, like I said, causes some people to mix that, because Muslim thought that it must have been to force religion, not to remove human tyranny. But there are lots of logical and factual information that make it clear that this conclusion is not really something that you get out of thin air. First of all, the whole notion of compulsion in religion is not only contradictory to the very text of the Quran, as we have amply documented, but it is contrary to the very logic of Islam. The very logic of Islam is surrender or commitment to voluntary choose to submit to the will of God and follow his commands and his way of life. And like I said before, no power on earth can impose something in your heart. So in Islamic law, it's not acceptable. If I force you and say, you believe or die and you believe, that's not acceptable within Islamic law itself. And as we indicated before, even a wife, a Christian wife of a Muslim, should not be bothered, and she should be free to practice her own faith, let alone strangers or others. The second point to keep in mind is that any cursory look at the map of the Muslim world today, with a population of nearly 1 billion all over the world, shows very conclusively that the great majority of Muslims today, great majority, live in places where conquest or the sword has no role whatsoever, not the immediate area where the early wars were taking place or conquest. Take an example. The largest Muslim country is Indonesia, with about 120 million Muslims, far there in Asia. Where was the sword? One-fourth of the population of Russia, about 50 million, are Muslims, suffering under all kinds of religious persecution, as everybody knows, which applies to other people of other faiths too. How did Islam spread in Russia? In China, not only this, we find that in places like Central and South Africa, there are many countries that are majority Muslims, or countries that have substantial minorities of Muslims. And it is well known that in many of those places, most of these places, I should say, the sword had no role to play. It was not war for forcing faith. In other faraway places like the Philippines, in Thailand, and other places, you find substantial Muslim minorities. And it is obvious that Islam spread there through merchants, through holy people, quote-unquote, or people who devoted themselves to that particular mission.
Indeed, I suppose Great Britain and North America itself would be other illustrations.
Well, that's another factor, and South America. Mm-hmm. And to the best of my knowledge, every day there are people both in the United States and Canada who are turning to Islam, and that includes people who are among the most educated and the most religiously minded people in North America. In Europe, the same thing. Where is the sword? Another point also is that if it is true, or if it were true, that Islam spread by the sword or military might, how is it that Islam continued to spread even much faster at the time of Muslim defeat? Like one Orientalist says that it's very strange that those who even attacked Islam, like the Seljuk Turks and like the Mongols, then they themselves as conquerors embraced Islam, which is contrary to any logic. You know, most of us would say that a conqueror imposes his religion. But those who invaded Muslim land, they themselves became Muslims. There are records of history also of some of the highly placed people among the Crusaders who came to attack Muslims under the excuse of liberating the Holy Land and all that stuff. But actually, they ended up themselves embracing Islam.
Brother Jamal, I'm sorry, we have to stop at that point. Unfortunately, we've run out of time for today's program. I want to thank you for appearing on Islam in Focus. I'd like to invite all of you back next week when we will start the new series on Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, as foretold in the Bible. Thank you for watching Islam in Focus. See you next week.
الله أكبر الله أكبر.